This program is brought to you by Haymarket Books as part of the Socialism 2024 program. You can hear more recordings from the conference by subscribing to the Socialism Conference podcast feed. Many video recordings are also available at socialismconference.org. If you enjoy these recordings, you should join us at Socialism 2025, which will be held in Chicago next summer, July 3rd through the 6th, 2025. If you are ready to put ideas into action and get organized with others from across the country and the world, make a plan with your organization and your friends to come to the Socialism Conference.
For Femme Fanon to Falestine, decolonial theory, or actually, as my comrade in my last session pointed out, it should be anti-colonial theory in practice. A couple of programming notes. So we have a couple of adjustments, and so we're going to, because of those adjustments, we're going to switch things up. Luckily, we still have from the A-team with us Roshan Dadu from South Africa, from the BDS movement, the national coordinator of the BDS movement in South Africa. Please welcome her. We were hoping to have Declan Kearney from Sinn Féin also join us, but unfortunately we're not able to make that happen. And we originally had Lara Kiswani from our Resource and Organizing Center to join us, but filling in her stead as an act of solidarity in action is my wonderful partner in the Palestine Solidarity Announcements, which is a regular Friday call with organizers from the Bay Area and beyond about what's happening on the ground in Palestine. We suggest you check it out. Samer does an amazing analysis of political conditions. If you find the information you're getting to be too much, Samer will digest it for you and regurgitate it in a way that makes sense. So please welcome Samer Arabi from also, I said from Iraq. Okay, so let me do the logistical kind of reminders from our wonderful comrades at Haymarket, who've done a great job of keeping us together and safe this conference. Just a reminder that we're all here to play a role in keeping ourselves safe and to keep your masks on while indoors in conference spaces. Mine is off because I am a speaker at a panel, and I will take them off. We will take ours off when we speak and replace them when we don't. Make sure to keep your badge on, even though, it's towards the end of the conference. There are badge checkers who are trying to keep us safe by making sure that everybody who is attending conference sessions is someone that is known to the organizers. Third, keep in mind that, this is supposed to be a space for encouraging genuine learning and discussion and debate among folks across the left. And in fact, that will be the shift here, is that we're going to do a little bit less talking at you and a lot more talking together. And then hopefully we will all come out of this with some lessons learned and some good, strong strategic questions to chew on. I have a couple questions. How many of you have been active in Palestine's solidarity work since this past October? How many of you have been active in Palestine? What about Roshan? Are you not? How many of you were active before October of last year? Cool. A lot of folks in here. And how many of you are still active? And how many of you plan to be active beyond the anniversary? That's amazing. Okay, so then this is the right group of people to have this conversation with, don't you think? Yeah?
That'll
yeah.
Do.
Great. Okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to, we're going to speak into the mic because we have some comrades that need us to speak loudly. And just as a reminder, we have comrades in here who may be getting interpretation or have other access needs. So we're going to try to support each other by speaking and having one mic and all that stuff that we all know how to do so well. And if not, I will be here to gently remind you. But we're going to take a look back at sort of the last 11 months a little bit and do some evaluation together. And then we're going to hear from Samer and Roshan on their reflections from their vantage points, both being Samer being a major part of AROC's strategy team and implementation team, looking across the national strategy in the U.S. and also globally, and then Roshan from the vantage point of South Africa and the global BDS movement as well. So what I want you to do is to find someone to your left, and I want you to think about this, talk about this question. I'll give you about 7 to 8 minutes, so 4 minutes each, and I'll post it when it's 4 minutes left. How would you, from your vantage point, the work that you've engaged in Palestine solidarity, measure the growth of leftist organizing around Palestine, and how would you assess its strength and value to the Palestinian struggle now and moving forward? Okay, so let me repeat that. How would you measure the growth of leftist organizing around Palestine this year, and how would you assess its strength and value to the Palestinian struggle now and moving forward? Did everyone get that? If you need me to repeat it again, raise your hand. Yeah, one more time. So how would you measure the growth of leftist organizing around Palestine this year? That's the first part. And then how would you assess its strength and value to the Palestinian struggle now and moving forward? Anyone else need me to repeat that again? Okay. So I'm going to give you about 8 minutes. Make sure I'll cue you when the other person should talk. But answer that question, and I would caution you to avoid thinking critically about what's missing, because we're going to get to that later, right? And I know maybe something that might be top of mind right now, but we want you to think about what growth we have made. Even if you're new to this work, you know, what you're, from your vantage point, what that experience is like. Okay, ready? Go ahead.
Hi, everyone. My name is Sirajam. I'm a Bangladeshi from New York. We talked about a few things. We talked about one measure of growth as the ability to directly connect with citizen journalists on the ground and get information from their mouth to battle the disinformation campaigns. And on that note, like realizing, like, it's been easier to identify like the parroting in mainstream media and other sources of information. And for the second question, one of the answers we came up with is the intersectional nature of the different movements coming together to understand like what's at stake for all of us when we ask, as a result of asking the Palestine question, whether it's that land back movement or climate justice movement, anti-racist movements, etc., queer rights. We assessed that's a value added to the struggle and will like strengthen the struggle moving forward.
Excellent. Thank you so much for sharing. Can we give a little warm applause for our comrades sharing? Can we just get one other group or one other person who wants to share? Yeah. Here, but yeah. Yeah, that's okay. Just speak loudly into the mic so everyone can hear.
Yeah. We talked about how, like, we were, like, measuring success mostly around, like, the narrative shifts. So, like, mainstream media, like, not being able to ignore us any longer and, like, having to pay attention to us. And there being, like, a lot of, like, successful narrative interventions around, like, Zionism as a colonial project. And, like, the national polls, like, indicating the majority of people like are in favor of like arms embargoes and stuff, but as far as like assessing strength, we talked about like the tensions around like if what we're doing is actually supporting Palestinians, and how if like maybe some of the direct actions that we're having are actually like amounting to changing the material conditions of Palestinians, and if they're like largely symbolic, even though they are contributing to a lot of these important narrative shifts. And then we talked a lot about like basically mobilizing versus organizing and like pulling people into the movement and building people power, and how a lot of like what we've been going through is also like collectively traumatic, and like how a lot of organizers want to do something but sometimes that means more like instant gratification for organizers instead of like actually coming into these spaces clear-headed and having like a clear strategy for how we move forward. And like that meaning that we also need to like make like spaces in our organizing to kind of like process grief before we're in like planning sessions.
Thank you very much. And you are an organizer, I can tell, because you didn't follow the assignment and you still gave critical feedback, which I really... They were like, we're doing the whole conjunctural analysis right now. We're not going to stop. I appreciate that. So let's hear from Roshan. Why don't you tell everyone a little bit more about yourself, and then also let's talk about the South African context, and then we can start, you know, digesting a little bit of what we've already heard.
Okay, thanks. Amandla!
Amandla.
It's away to the response. Amandla!
Away to.
thanks, comrades. First of all, my name's Roshan Dadu, as was said, and I'm the coordinator of the South African BDS Coalition. But just to say something about the coalition, it's I think it was about 4 years ago we started trying to bring together different groups of different solidarity groups in the country. So, for instance, groups on different campuses, South African Jews for a Free Palestine. There was a Palestine Solidarity Campaign, which I'm also a member of, which was the longest standing solidarity group. And then groups from different places and groups organizing in different communities. So we've come together as the South African BDS Coalition, and we're affiliated to the Palestinian BDS National Committee. But having said all that, because it's a coalition, I think I should also say that what my reflections now and what we'll speak about here is really in my personal capacity, because I obviously can't speak on behalf of a very big variety of people's views and opinions and so on. And also just to say the reason I sound like this is because I grew up in exile. My parents were activists in the South African Communist Party and the ANC and so on in our liberation struggle. So I kind of grew up in solidarity activism in the anti-apartheid movement before getting involved, coming back after 1994 to South Africa and being involved in activism and organizing and politics and so on from within South Africa. So I always appreciate Palestinians that have to explain why they sound like they do, because they're in exile in America or Europe or somewhere. So having said all that, what was the question?
Positives.
Measuring growth.
I mean, I think, the South African context, and maybe sort of in a little while could give a bit more of a background. I think we have found as well, that obviously there's been this tremendous growth of interest, support, people wanting to do something. And new groups have sprung up, such as African Artists Against Apartheid, which just sprung up, on their own, but have now come together as an enormous group of people, and now they've divided into musicians and this and that and the other. So that's been really great. And that came about from university students putting out a call. They were having one demonstration, and they wanted to know if there are any musicians that could come and play. And they put out this call, and they got 400 people responding. And so it kind of organized itself into what they decided to call Beyond South Africa, African Artists Against Apartheid. And also there are people from other African countries in that. The other group that really has come together is Healthcare Workers for Palestine, which, again, it was academic medical people and other medics people in the whole healthcare professions that also just came together and formed this Healthcare Workers for Palestine, and they've been doing amazing stuff. I mean, some of them had already been active in different ways. For instance, there's a very excellent guy who's from, I think he's at Stellenbosch University, he's been going over years to Gaza. He's a psychology professor and dealing with, sort of doing all sorts of psychotherapy type of things. And then again, because South Africa, which is what something I wanted to get to, still has full relations with Israel, and there are reasons for that, not excuses. We import Teva drugs, and Teva is one of those companies on the boycott list, and these healthcare workers have now got 22 pharmacies to commit to not stocking Teva. And so when they do so, they put up a sign that we made saying, apartheid-free zone, this pharmacy is an apartheid-free zone. So they have really been, you know, taking action both in universities and on the ground. And then, of course, student groups, which were...
Wait, hold on. I think
oh,
we
sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, other groups have grown. Student groups always go up and down depending what, you know, who is, when people leave, and then new committees and so on and so on. But of course, they've grown, and they've taken inspiration from the students in America and the encampments. And there were two universities that had encampments for a while. Academics have also been putting resolutions, which has never happened before. And now there are six universities that have passed resolutions, five of which call for full academic boycott, which is quite amazing. Two, it's extremely contested. They are fighting tooth and nail. And even in those ones, those five, you know, the Senate's vote. So you can see sometimes it's a close vote. So it means not only are there, you know, now academics have come off the fence and are actually prepared, who are not activists. You know, activists on the campus were small, but they've been trying to organize. But there's still a sort of a block within academia, which reflects also the rest of South African society, of people who are prepared to vote against a resolution calling for a ceasefire and certainly calling for an academic boycott. And just yesterday, apparently, some UCT, University of Cape Town academics, who were displeased with the motion that was passed, which wasn't that strong, have taken a court action against, if you read it, it lists sort of like 40 people, like all the individual academics that voted for the motion, saying it's unconstitutional in terms of our country's constitution and the UCT constitution. So it is contested in South Africa. You know, it's not, I know it seems because of things like the ICJ case, people feel that it's the entire country is kind of behind it, whereas I would say the majority probably are, but it's contested. Another recent victory, can I just say one more? I didn't know we had so many till I thought about it, was we're trying to get, so South Africa's the third biggest exporter of coal to Israel. Colombia was the first, Russia's the second. And it's not that much of our exports, but it's quite a large percentage of Israel's imports. And obviously they use coal to produce electricity, and that, you know, clearly I think we can say it's fueling the genocide and the illegal occupation. So we're on a campaign around that. So far, we haven't got a response from any of the relevant government departments in South Africa, but we did manage to get the Namibian government 2 days ago to refuse docking rights. It wasn't, in fact, a coal ship. It was a weapons ship. It was a tip-off that this ship, if you spot it, Catherine it's called, was carrying weapons. And so we got the Namibian government to rescind docking rights. It was, you know, when you look on those ship trackers, it was like heading towards Walvis Bay. So then the ship went out again, and now it's dithering. So now we're trying to put pressure. And in fact, Francesca Albanese tweeted about this today, put pressure on the Angolan government, which is a much harder ask than Namibia, is much more solid in support of Palestine. And then Portugal, which is where the ship is from. Anyway, that was quite a victory of comrades in South Africa through our Pan-African network, getting hold of their government in Namibia. So that was quite, I mean, it's a small victory, but we're very pleased that we have not had in our hood, if you like, a ship, which actually was reported that the Namibia government did investigate the cargo, and it was indeed carrying explosives. So, you know, I think that was quite a big deal for us in Southern Africa anyway. But I'll stop there.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Give a little warm applause.
Oh, yeah, thanks. Thank you all so much for being here. My name is Samer. I'm a member of the Arab Resource and Organizing Center, a San Francisco Bay Area-based organization that supports Arab and Muslim communities with legal services, advocacy, youth campaigns, and other campaign work. We work hard for the empowerment and liberation of our peoples, both here in the belly of the beast and in our homelands, and see our struggles as inextricably tied to the struggles of liberation with all other communities. When I speak about like my perspectives on these things, I'll be coming at it from AROC's perspective, sort of this organization that's been working on Palestine solidarity and Palestine liberation for a few decades now. And reflecting on the strengths, you know, I think there's a lot of visible change in the past 11 months that I think, you know, there's a lot we have rightfully feel a lot of pride in. And I think it's worth reflecting for a minute about the foundations on which those successes were built. And I think those come in two forms. One is building on the other struggles here in the United States that, you know, in solidarity with like Movement for Black Liberation and abolitionists and all that has been done in these other related struggles that allow us to stand on their shoulders. The Palestine solidarity movement as it looks in the United States wouldn't look like this if it wasn't for the Movement for Black Lives, if it wasn't for the Sunrise Movement and all the other incredible leftist organizing that's allowed us to sort of build on their momentum and narrative. But there's a second piece of that too that I think is often under-considered, which is the seeds that the Palestine advocacy movement has been planting for decades now is starting to bear fruit in a way that I think is really important and reflects the sort of long fight that sometimes we don't see because we're really focused on what's happening right in front of us all the time. But, you know, in addition to, you know, bringing up the issue of Palestine and connecting the issue of Palestine to everything else, Palestine organizers have been deeply embedded in a lot of these other fights and a lot of these other movements. You know, one of the things that I've been really struck by when I was lucky enough to meet Cori Bush a few months ago, who told me that when the uprising in Ferguson started, it was Palestinians on the ground who showed the people there like how to fight back against tear gas, how to protect yourself from police brutality. These are things that they had been experiencing for decades. It was not new to them, and so they were able to sort of share that sort of learning in a way that, you know, I think we've seen similarly in struggles elsewhere. You know, me and some other folks here were at Line 3 in Minnesota fighting with the water protectors. And again, these questions about, like, you know, the colonial theft of water and natural resources, nothing new. And so building on all of that momentum, connecting those struggles together have allowed this sort of, like, moment in Palestine solidarity organizing to be, you know, we read a piece from Max Elbaum recently who refers to it as the first sustained movement at scale with internationalism at its center in more than a decade. Right, and that's a huge, huge victory. That's something I think we really need to, like, and not only that, but done in a way with intersectionality at its center, right? The idea that when we talk about Palestine, we talk about it as part of a broader global struggle, which is a thing that I think was not missing, but less visible in, say, like, Iraq War organizing, right, or Afghanistan organizing, which tended to be movements that were, at least in the sort of public-facing perception of them, were very white, right? And were very sort of strictly about the war and not about militarism as a broader conception of how American empire functions. And because of that different orientation, we're seeing a different outcome. And I think a way that that's showing up is changing the discourse for how Palestine organizing works, right? Like, I think folks in this room would agree that concept of progressive except for Palestine is dead, right? It's dead. It felt insurmountable 5 years ago, and now it no longer exists, right? It's like a fringe, loony position that people take. You know, along with that, right, we're seeing a massive shift in discourse and public opinion in a way that, you know, if you had, again, asked us 5 years ago, we were making plans about the long-term campaign for an arms embargo against Israel, and that was a 20-year strategy plan. And now it's feeling like a 20-month strategy plan, right? It's still not here, but it's a lot closer than it used to be. You know, we're at a point now where the majority of Democrats, and I think the plurality of people in the United States generally, favor conditioning aid to Israel or ending it altogether. That's new, and that's huge, right? We're not seeing that in the political class, and that's, you know, Thomas specifically told me to focus on the positives, so I'll wait to talk about that later. But we are seeing cracks in the so-called bipartisan consensus. You know, this idea that, like, support for Israel is just this assumed aspect of American politics, again, no longer true. And partly as a result of that, we're seeing incredible growth in the BDS movement, right? Like, BDS has become a thing in the United States that it could not have been even just a few years ago, you know? And AROC worked very hard, for example, on the Block the Boat campaign, which I imagine folks are familiar with, you know, stopping Israeli ships from docking in U.S. ports. Those were big victories when they happened in those, like, individual actions. You know, AROC, along with all of our allies in the labor movement and elsewhere, have successfully stopped any Israeli ships from docking in the San Francisco Bay Area for over a decade now. But thank you. We're very proud of that. But now the local stevedores union in the San Francisco Bay Area, IAWU Local 10, has issued a statement saying that they will never, right? They refuse to dock and support any Israeli ships or anything that supports the genocide in Palestine. These are huge shifts, and they're not just happening there. You know, like when you that letter that was put out by labor unions representing, I think, 40% of organized labor. At this point, unions representing over half of organized labor have come out in favor of a ceasefire. But over 40% of organized labor at this point, I think, has specifically come out very strongly for arms embargo. And, you know, obviously labor is the thing that keeps this country moving, and that is a massive material impact on the ability of the U.S. war machine to keep this genocide going. So a big win that I think will have repercussions going down the line. And beyond all of that, I guess, like, my kind of closing reflection on it is it feels like there's a lot further to go, but it also feels like we've turned a corner. Like, we're also not going back. So the question is how we move from where we've gotten now to where we need to go. We still have a very long way to go. But it's important, I think, to take a moment to reflect on not only how much we've won, but the irreversibility of it. Right, that these gains are sort of foundational to leftist and progressive organizing now in a way that allows us to sort of build upon them instead of having to keep fighting for that initial push. I guess I'll leave it there. Thanks, y'all.
Free, free Palestine.
Free, free Palestine.
Free, free Palestine.
Free, free Palestine.
Yeah, the volume's picked up because you're all energized by that, right? Wasn't so hard to talk about. I saw you go, you said big, huge. It wasn't so hard to stay positive. It wasn't so hard to stay positive. I mean, Roshan wouldn't stop giving me examples. See? If we just do one thing at a time, we can do this thing. Okay, so again, we want this to be a conversation, so I want you to find, Samer was just criticizing the fact that everybody doesn't have someone to their left, and that is true, but as a set of organizers, you all self-organized, and it was fine. So again, find someone to your left for a conversation, or get in a small group, and I want you to answer this question. I'm going to simplify the version I give Samer and Roshan. What are some of the strategic tensions within the left that you've witnessed around Palestine solidarity? So what are your deltas, or what are the room things that are missing? What are the things that you have consternation about? And I want you to specifically try to think about stuff, you know, without getting into, you know, naming individual people within your cohort, but, like, you know, something that's specific to dynamics or the terrain in which you're organizing that you think are challenges for Palestine solidarity at the current moment. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah? Okay, great. So I will give you another 8 minutes, 4 and 4, and please start now.
Hi,
Hi, everybody. My name is Lama. I met... Oh, my God. Can you remind me your name?
Kate.
Who, right now, I live in the Tampa Bay area. Kate used to live in the Tampa Bay area, so it was cool because we got to connect about some of that stuff. But Kate lives in Chicago right now, and surprise, surprise, we're experiencing some of the same tensions. Some of the tensions that we talked about was the caucasity in the movement. It's real. So real. So for where I'm based out of in the Tampa Bay area, there has not been like a long time like Palestine, like organizing around Palestine, even though we do have the largest population of Palestinians in the area. So, you know, trying to bring folks into the movement in a different way has been a struggle. And one of the things that I was talking to Kate about was like we've been building a coalition over the last few months of these leftist organizations, but we've never really worked with each other before, so we're coming into the space with a lot of distrust. Mm. And I think that's causing like a lot of those tensions and preventing us from being able to have like real conversations about accountability. And Kate was also mentioning how some of the, like folks that are newer to organizing spaces are coming in with like a lot of ideological purity and just like there's only one way to do this and anybody else that's doing it any other way is completely wrong. And so, you know, we don't have this, you know, diversity of tactics and strategies, which, I mean, I do think there is a line of that. Like, there are things that are genuinely detrimental, and some of these things are genuinely keeping us from working and collaborating with each other.
Thank you. Can we get a warm welcome applause for our comrades? Thank you, Lama. How about one or two more? Another comrade right here. Yeah, please.
My name is Shireen. So I was just talking with Sammy. I'm a Palestinian citizen of Israel, so I live back home. And I was just sharing, but I think this is translated also here as well, where within Palestinians, within the Israeli context, where we a lot... Oh, sorry. Is that better?
Yeah, that's great.
Okay.
I'm like... Can you take your mask off before
you're talking? Yeah,
Yeah, we're
okay.
Asked to keep our masks on, yeah.
So I'll just say it really quickly. I was saying that I'm a Palestinian from the Israel, like I'm an Israeli citizen, Palestinian. And something that I've noticed within our context is a lot of time we struggle, especially looking into the systems that are in place, and we're trying to figure out how can we free ourselves within these systems, or what kind of movements can we do within the systems. So we were talking about how a lot of time we're looking for leadership, but then we feel like we don't have leaders in particular. So for example, during the 2021 uprising within Palestine, where that was the first time that I, as a Palestinian, felt very close with other Palestinians, whether it was West Bank or Jerusalem or the diaspora, because we felt this kind of thinking that was outside of any tradition or typical structure. So I think it's that thought that we're always looking within existing structures of how to move, and we sometimes forget that we can get outside of these existing structures and create newer structures or something. Yeah, so I think that's something that, yeah, just came up. Thank you.
Thank you, Shireen. And then one more from our comrade, purple hair. Yes.
So I just real quick, actually, Ilan Pape responded to that exact question. I don't know if you heard it, about how like basically we have to kind of see if you know, which side to take, and I think where the contradictions are really, really getting. Basically, his answer was that Palestinians of Israeli citizenship need to pick one or the other system. Either you go with the Palestinian political system or you go with the Israeli system. But what I was going to say was that I'm co-chair of DSA's Palestine subcommittee. And we definitely are dealing with the caucasity issue as well. And I've kind of come to the conclusion after talking to a lot of folks, doing a lot of things, is that we need to kind of work on two things. One is the political education. Like, for example, this question of resistance and Hamas comes up. And I think there is a lot, a lot of the lack of support for Hamas or whatever is because of ignorance. And quite frankly, because of Islamophobia. I'm Muslim. I grew up Muslim. And I in October 7th, I caught myself, like, buying into some of the Islamophobic narratives. And then I had to think back, like, wait a minute. like, what do I know about Islamic groups? What do I know about, like, these types of, like, because, like, I'm not Palestinian, but I come from a country where we have similar movements, and I had to kind of recalibrate and think back, because if I'm brainwashed and Islamophobic, y'all are too. Like, do not, like it. We have this ongoing issue. People try to tell us that our organization is not Islamophobic. Bullshit. Like, and we have that issue in America, and so I know that, like, and if you're interested, join DSA. It's not going to be a lot of fun, but it'll be somewhat fun. it's fun if you like to fight. But yeah, like, I really, really, like, you know, political education for me is the biggest thing, because I think a lot of Americans just don't know. We're the most brainwashed population on this earth. You know, like, North Koreans are way, way more aware than we are. So yeah, that's just kind of, and I would love to hear any thoughts y'all have about that as well.
Thank you. Can you thank our comrades for sharing a little bit? Okay. Let's talk about this, Samer and Roshan. Samer, you want to go first? And just maybe, let's talk a little bit about the thing I knew you love to talk about, which is all that's wrong. No, I'm kidding. The critiques.
Yeah, love me a critique. I really appreciate that we had the opportunity to hear from some of you, because that all felt really spot on. I think there's a lot there to unpack, and I think it's hard, right? I would say one of the core issues is, as folks talked about, the struggle that we've had to cohere as a unified movement around a sort of unified strategy and vision. And I don't think that that means that everybody has to have the same perspective on tactics and structure or even end goal, but rather that we at least as a movement need to cohere around the concept of, like, we should be fighting our enemies, right? Not, like, sniping at each other. And I think that's been happening a lot, right? The DNC fiascos felt a little bit like all of those things distilled in one, right? Like, there was a lot of infighting around the idea of what the right strategy there was. There was a lot of concerns about, you know, the sort of, like, I feel like we've almost fallen into a sort of inside camp, outside camp. And I don't know that that's a really effective, I mean, it's definitely not an effective way for us to be getting where we need to get, because even if one of those tendencies might be like grounded in a different, or, you know, like, even say a better assessment, going out of our way to sort of undermine the folks who are doing things a little bit differently often just doesn't produce valuable returns, you know? I think part of that is that as a movement, we struggle with contradiction. You know, we really struggle to grapple with the ways that problems can embody multiple solutions, and or we have to engage in strategic alliances in the short term in order to achieve bigger things in the longer term. You know, that the Thomas and I were just talking about this before the session started, actually, about, you know, we were talking about the namesake of our panel, Fanon, and, like, some of the contradictions even inherent in there. Like, if folks have read Wretched of the Earth, and I imagine many of you who are in this room probably have, you know, there's a really powerful foreword by Jean-Paul Sartre, you know, like, who, in a way that to this day gives me goosebumps when I read about, you know, he talks about how the global South has moved on from the idea of this, like, Western narrative structure, right? This concept that, like, you know, I think the phrase he uses, like, the world is fed up with our lies. You know, they see right through them, right? The hypocrisy and nonsense of it. And that was, I think, in the early 60s, if I'm not mistaken. And a few years after Jean-Paul Sartre penned that, he then penned a defense of the Israeli attack in 1967, right? That led to Fanon's wife, Josie Fanon, who has been a lifelong supporter of Palestinian liberation, to ask that he be removed from the foreword of her late husband's book, which never happened. But, you know, her idea was, like, you can't, if you don't understand that, like, you should be committing everything to Palestinian liberation, you haven't understood the book, right? And so, like, how can this person write a foreword if they're still supporting the, like, Israeli colonial project? I think that's absolutely the right and correct moral stance to take, and, like, it's valuable to take Sartre's support for the Algerian liberation in the context that it was in. It's hard to hold both of those things at the same time. So I think engaging with that contradiction is difficult, right? And like making sure that our achievements and the work that we're doing is grounded in a sort of assessment of the material conditions of the environment in which we operate is a key part of that, you know, so that it's not like, what is the ideal thing to do? What do we ideally want in a world divorced of, you know, the muck that we're in? But we're in the muck, right? Given that we're in the muck, you know, it makes the fight harder, you know, and the fight, obviously, like, the concept of Palestinian liberation is not complicated. It's extremely clear. It's a settler colonial state and an indigenous group of people fighting for their liberation. But what levers we pull here can be complicated, you know, and I think we have to consider that we're, you know, particularly for us in the belly of the beast, how we relate to how to shift power within the greatest enabler of the Israeli colonial project, frankly, the enabler of the settler colonial project. Like, without U.S. support, it ends tomorrow, you know? Given that, how can we meaningfully change conditions of power here? And, you know, I think the AIPAC primarying out members of the squad was another example of this, where, like, as a movement, we failed to cohere around a shared narrative, where, like, I think there's an argument to be made about, you know, like, oh, you know, Democrats are like the party of making, you know, fascism a little more friendly. And, like, I don't know that, you know, protesting AIPAC's biggest opponent is the move, you know? Like, you can sit that out, and that's fine. But, like, stopping people from voting for Jamal Bowman, not probably not the best use of our time and resources as a movement. Personally. So that's one big thing. And then the other, I would say, and folks touched on this a little bit too, and actually now that I think about it, this is also something that came out of The Wretched of the Earth, which is, you know, the idea of the weakness of spontaneity, right? That we have been, we've been surfing on this wave of spontaneous movement, right? We've been surfing on protest, and we've been surfing on top of rebellion, even on some levels, right? The sort of rejection of the conditions of the society that have produced this situation. But that's not sustainable. And I'm sure a lot of folks are feeling that now, and I'm sure a lot of folks are seeing, like, the dwindling numbers at rallies and the, you know, the burnout in our movement, the collective trauma that we're all processing. That's understandable. I'm definitely feeling that. I am exhausted every hour of every day. My poor partner. Like, rebellion is not revolution, right? We need to move from this spontaneous phase into a more sustainable, long-term fight. And we need to understand that that fight takes time, you know? Even as I talked about the acceleration of the movement that's been happening over this past year in particular, things are happening a lot faster than a lot of us thought they would. That still doesn't mean that it's going to be over tomorrow, right? You know, and even in, like, the simplest version of that would be, like, you know, I hope I eat my words on this, but I don't think I will. Ceasefire's not coming, right? It's not happening this week. It's not happening next week. And if it doesn't happen now, there's, you know, maybe some hope that, like, a different administration in the United States might pull different levers. Whether that's a realistic assessment or not, I don't know, but it's a conceivable one. But even in that context, you're talking 5 months out, right? So earliest this ends in terms of how the U.S. can impact the trajectory of the current stage of the genocide in Gaza is 5 months out. And so the long-term project of Palestinian liberation is a long-term project. You need to dig in for the long run, which means, you know, we can't live off this, like, immediate response reaction sort of vibe that we've been feeding off of for the past 11 months. It will not sustain it. Fanon has a lot to say about the difference between like the spontaneous phase of a revolution and the sort of longer term work. And the longer term work is less sexy, right? It's not as fun. Not that any of this has been fun, but I think folks take my meaning. And maybe the last thing I'll say, I think I've been yammering. The other big thing that folks surfaced that I think is worth reflecting on a bit is the complicated relationship we have to decolonial violence, Right? It's hard, I think, for us to engage with that in a way that is coherent across the movement. And I think the sort of short, easy answer to that is obviously that we here in the United States or elsewhere are in no position to judge, right, how folks throw off, you know, the ethnic cleansing of their own people. We're in no position to judge one way or the other. And, you know, it ends up in, this is something that I've actually heard several times at different panels throughout the conference this week, not about Palestine, actually. You know, the other panel, Thomas very wonderfully moderated on techno-fascism, talked about the same thing, which is the weaponization of the moral panic as a way of like instituting these sort of systems of control and domination. And we've seen that very, very, very explicitly in the Palestine stuff, right? Where, you know, the fact that Kamala Harris is still talking about like October 7th rapes, you know, while the documented, proven daily rape of Palestinians by Israeli forces continues to be utterly ignored, right? And it's a product of colonial systems of domination, where the whole idea is the dehumanization of a people. You know, so the rape of an Israeli body, right, is this very visceral conception to the U.S. imagination, where an almost animalistic form of violence is inflicted upon them, whereas in reality it is the inverse, you know, where Palestinians are being treated like animals, right, and subject to these horrific forms of violence that don't reach the level of popular consciousness. And I think it's important for us to make sure that that is centered in a way that it's certainly not in mainstream discourse. Yeah, and there's a lot to say about that, but I've been talking too much already, so maybe I'll pass it to Roshan. Thank you all.
Thanks. I think it's really interesting to hear, because, you know, in a way it makes me realize how the context of South Africa is quite different. I mean, we have just as many tensions and contradictions, but, you know, coming from the global south, or the third world, as we used to call it, we have no problem with resistance. I mean, you know, like, we had an armed struggle. We don't have essentially any problem. We understand that oppressed people have the right to resist however way they choose. We, the relationship between the ANC and the PLO at the time was very strong. They met up together all around the place at different, you know, conferences and Bandung stories and so on, non-aligned movement things. And before that also received military training. There were comrades from South Africa and from Palestine and other countries that trained together in the Soviet Union and other places. So, you know, we don't have really a problem with that as such. And I think also in terms of, it's odd the way that things like Western Islamophobia is, you know, our mainstream media is pretty bad. It's better than here on Palestine, but it's still, you know, the number of times they won't interview one of us because they can't find someone from the Jewish Board of Deputies, and then, you know, to speak as well, and then it's not balanced. The framing of it they take from the Western media, partly because there are less and less staff employed, journalists employed, newsrooms are shrinking, and so the easiest thing is simply to take from the wires, as it used to be called, and take from what's already there. So we have this kind of funny contradiction where, on the one hand, you know, we have no problem with armed resistance, but on the other hand, the mainstream media is still, you know, in a way as bad in presenting the story. It still, you know, gets into people's heads that Hamas is somehow, you know, nothing to do with the liberation movement. It's an Islamist force and what have you not, and all the atrocities that have been disproven and so on and so on. But I think one of the challenges we have is sort of the opposite, in that people see Palestine as a Muslim issue. And there's a relatively small Muslim community of which half my family are part of, the other half is South African Jews. And to move to try to reframe the issue, it's not a Muslim issue, it's an issue of anti-colonial struggle just like ours and blah, blah, blah. That's one of the challenges, which is sort of different maybe to here. And that's also a legacy of living in a post-apartheid country where those sort of communities are still quite divided. You know, the legacy of apartheid is very far from being overcome. And so, you know, communities tend to turn in on themselves as well and become more and more conservative. So, you know, there's a very strong conservative element in the Muslim community, totally would support, you know, everything in Palestine and the Islamic movements there and so on and so on, but are not concerned with solidarity work and activism and certainly not intersectional movements. And in a way, sometimes it feels like they are almost resentful of other people getting involved on Palestine because it's their issue and, you know, who are we? And then additionally, there are other issues, you know, around Queers for Palestine. It's a very contentious issue, although there is a group, Queers for Palestine, very small, but they're growing, even though our constitution guarantees the rights of sexual orientation and so on. In reality, that's not, you know, largely accepted, and certainly the Muslim community is, and I think this comes from somewhere, it comes from somewhere else, this sudden upswing of taking a very anti-queer turn. Anyway, so that becomes a sort of breaking point in the solidarity movement, and it's quite a tricky one to navigate because we don't want to, you know, we're not going to abandon our principles around this, but that means that it's not as a cohesive, often, a movement in that respect as it could be. Other problems, you know, our trade union movement is very weak compared to how it used to be. So trying to get, we worked with AROC in 2021 in the Unity Intifada moments, and we kind of half successfully blocked an Israeli Zimline ship in Durban Harbour, very much, you know, on the model of the community protest and the unions. But, you know, our union, trade unions are very, very weak at the moment, and it's very hard to get concrete action. We managed now to get the National Union of Mine Workers on side with the coal embargo campaign, but there's also tensions there with the environmental justice movements, and so we're trying to find a sort of chart a way around the just transition issue. Fortunately, the NUM did at one point produce a very good document on a worker-led just transition. But, you know, the intersectionality comes with those issues. But I'm really pleased that we have actually, in the last year, managed to bring other movements into this story. So environmental justice activists have thrown in themselves into the coal story and, you know, all the other examples which had not been the case before. And I think the other huge issue we have is Christian Zionism. I don't know if anyone else was at the panel. It was really interesting to hear how the churches here, how people here are, you know, trying to undo and overcome this false Christian narrative that's taken a grip. I mean, it comes from America, obviously, but I mean, in South Africa, in the rest of Africa, it's so bad. You know, these churches hold so much sway beyond anyone else, you know, beyond the reaches of the political establishment of any sort. That they're in everyone's business. Everyone goes to some or other church. So even, you know, ANC politicians go to these churches and, you know, then start to have kind of backtrack, and there's the pressure from the Zionists. You know, we have, I would say that now, the only indigenous Zionist, organized Zionist, Jewish Zionist community in the continent. So we do have, you know, the regular Board of Deputies, the Zionist Federation, we have South Africa Friends of Israel, And that in particular was set up recently-ish in order to work with these pastors. And they literally give poor pastors money to support Israel and take them on those trips, you know, where those Christian whatnot trips, and indoctrinate them. Now we have an additional story after our last election in May this year, where the ANC vote dropped below the point of holding a majority in parliament. And we now have Zionist ministers, because what then happened was there was a formation of what they call a government of national unity. Now, not only had been the official opposition, the Democratic Alliance, which is basically a white party that, you know, carries the legacy of the National Party to some extent, or at least the English-speaking white parties, but, you know, is basically that. But now we have these other funny populist parties. So we have, as Minister of Sports and Culture, a Minister, Gayton McKenzie, who's been convicted of gangsterism, just a total lover of Israel. Last year he was in Israel, paid for a trip, of course, and now he's a minister. So there's sort of like a lot of contradictory stuff going on that's very specific in a way to South Africa. But the Christian Zionism thing, I think, is a problem for the whole of Africa, and it's really hindered in many ways the growth of the movement, because it takes it away from being a seen as an anti-colonial struggle. And that old sense that was there in the 70s, and I think Yasser Arafat was very good and skillful at especially targeting Africa as a focus, and he would travel around, everybody knew him. He put Palestine into the situation where we talk of it as part of Africa, and that sort of and there were attempts to try to get the Arab League and the OAU at the time together. It never quite worked for various reasons, but after Oslo, and that's something else I think we do need to address, after Oslo, the PA just sort of thought, well, you know, they can rely on Africa. And so they have just not paid attention. They have really, you know, not, their embassies are not active. It's for decades now. In the meanwhile, Israel redeveloped a new strategy for Africa. And the upshot of that was, we saw in the underhanded way that Israel tried to gain a seat as an observer status at the African Union. I mean, their intention was to split the vote. You know, you need Africa's vote in the UN system, in the General Assembly especially. They didn't achieve that. And I think, you know, now it's going to be even harder for them. But, you know, it's been very difficult to resist with the normalization. Morocco's one of the big culprits. It was through Morocco returning to the AU that brought Israel in its tail, as always. You know, that they use Morocco for that. The DRC. That was my last issue on this. One of the hasbaras that we face now from the Christian Zionist especially, oh, but why should you care about Palestine? What about the DRC? What about Sudan? You know, conflicts in our continent. Plus, in a country which is the most unequal in the world, what about people in South Africa? Why are you concerned with Palestine when people here, you know, there is abject poverty and all the statistics and, you know, massive unemployment and so on. So for us, it's trying to, you know, as here also in many ways, relate Palestine to those struggles, but also relate it in the way that internationalism and what third worldism had been in days gone by, where you're talking about it being one struggle. And so Madiba's words, our freedom is incomplete without the freedom of the Palestinian people, is really profound, because, I mean, we use it all the time, and it has not yet become a cliche, because literally we are trying to make that point that it is one struggle, that when you're talking to people who have no housing, who have invaded land in the edge of a township, and you're talking to them about Palestine, why should they care? Well, because it's one struggle. If the Palestinian people win, is going to be a massive win for us as well. And as the struggle against apartheid was a kind of a win on the way towards something better, but, you know, against racism, it was a win for movements around the world. And so I think rekindling, you know, the kind of spirit of Fanon, if I'm not talking about specifically what he said and so on, but that spirit that I grew up with, where you just, you know, the Vietnam War, you supported, you knew who to support, you knew they were fighting the same struggle. And, you know, there are all those many reasons why that's changed. But I do think, you know, if you look at the, I don't know if I can go on a bit, the history, 1948, both apartheid regimes came into being, the State of Israel and Nakba. The apartheid regime elected into power in South Africa. Those regimes were so close together that they developed not only weapons, but nuclear weapons. South Africa had nuclear weapons, Israel has nuclear weapons. South Africa decommissioned them after 1994. But, you know, that relationship was so strong that one of the first people who described Israel as an apartheid state was Hendrik Verwoerd, the architect of apartheid. So he should know. And he said, Israelite South Africa is an apartheid state. So this relationship, I mentioned, you know, the liberation struggles relationship, but the relationship there has always been, you know, there's been this relationship that's so strong that still continues to this day that we're trying to undo. So things like the ICJ case, obviously, you know, that was a massive boost, and we were so proud, and we gathered together to watch, you know, it was like, oh my God, you know, what are they going to say? What are they going to do? And each time the provisional measures have been, you know, agreed upon, and that fact of, was, you know, Noura's panel yesterday on international, it is important. Just quickly, in our struggle, we had what we described as four pillars. We had the arms struggle, we had the underground struggle because all the political movements were banned. We had mass mobilization that went from passive resistance, defiance campaign, to making townships ungovernable. And then we had international solidarity. And I think, you know, in our view, it's the working together of all of those elements. So when there's an upswing in the struggle, as there was here, like 76, when the school students, and that was in a way a kind of quite a spontaneous, it wasn't just in Soweto, it actually happened all over the country. That boosted the international solidarity movement, boosted the anti-apartheid movement. And so you go forward suddenly, very quickly, you become, you know, you make inroads, people are aware, people join, they want to be active, and then it sort of dies down. And I think each time you just want to try to be slightly better organized in the dying down, knowing that it will die down. You can't sustain momentum forever, as you said, you know, that kind of spontaneous momentum for all those reasons. But if you can just be a little bit further along, and then time-wise, things go slowly and then suddenly very rapidly. So, I mean, it took decades and decades for the anti-apartheid movement to reach the point where people, in general, wouldn't buy a South African apple. They had some sense, you know, whether they were political or not, that this is not a good thing and we shouldn't do it. Decades and decades of folding leaflets. It was before technology, you know, typing on typewriters. Photocopiers were invented. It was massive, you know. And then folding the things all together and then posting them to people. Like, you know, it took decades of doing that stuff to get to that point. So I think, you know, people mustn't also despair. I think nowadays people want a quick fix and, oh, but we keep protesting and nothing's happened. Well, you know, it takes decades, but sometimes you have very quick moves forward, and we should, you know, be aware that we're in that momentum at the moment, and you go with it, but that you try to strengthen yourselves for the times when you know that's going to calm down a bit. And, of course, it depends on the struggle on the ground. And, you know, October the 7th was remarkable. It was just so remarkable. And we have to celebrate the fact that, you know, of that resistance. And you never know. 2021 wasn't, you didn't know it would be, you know, what became called the Unity Intifada. So not to despair, but to be aware that it's a long journey, as you said. Sorry, that was a bit...
No. Long. How... How fortunate are we that Roshan has braved a really extremely excessively long flight to come from South Africa to join us and to share so much insight. We have a little bit of time. It'd be great to get a couple of questions and comments. Yeah, please.
I'm Iranian, and I'm in the Iranian movement for a while. One important part of the Palestinian movement is today is I feel separate Zionism from Judaism. But the problem I have right now, because in Iran we have same problem. We are trying to separate fundamentalism from Islam, because Iranian people are Muslim and I support them, but Iranian government is fundamentalist. The problem I see in the Middle East is we couldn't separate this part. And even Fanon mentioned about that, at least as much as I read from Franz Fanon, discuss about that, warning Ali Shariati, one of the scholar, an Iranian scholar, warning him about role of Islam. He said, yeah, people are Muslim, but we need to be a secular movement. We can't be going to that direction. So this is contradiction, which we didn't answer. For example, in Iran, when Haniya killed by Israel government, Iranian government execute 80 people in the jail, which they were part of the Women's Life Freedom Movement. So you see contradiction. This contradiction can be didn't resolve. As an activist, we resolve. We try to separate it. But I don't see in the Middle East or in the region, they trying to resolve that one. And we have a problem in this area, at least Iranian activists have a problem. Some even that they don't want to support is a Palestinian movement because of that. I can say they are a little bit right-wing, but those which they are supporting Palestinian movement rightfully, they are supporting Iranian movement. They are not supporting the fundamentalism. This is our dilemma in Middle East, and I don't know what you are thinking. I want to see you.
Thank you, Carmen. Let's get a couple more. Yeah, please give a warm applause. If you get a couple more on stack, and then we'll try to answer them as we close out. If you want to come up to the front, the comrade in the back with the raised hand. And is there any more? Maybe we can take at least one more comment. Or question? Okay, we'll close out with this comrade, and then we'll get some final. Oh, and then our comrade right here, Chico.
Hello, thank you so much for being here and making the long journey. I wanted to ask a question that I think is very important, because I hear a lot of people advocate for a one-state solution, and I know that especially in the past there was a lot of talk about a two-state solution, especially since there was kind of the international consensus on it, and it seemed like it was just the U.S. and Israel standing alone to oppose it. So my question is, if, you know, since we have so much responsibility here in the U.S., then we want to try and affect what we can, and it seems like a pretty straightforward strategy to tell our government, you know, obey international law. International law says there should be two states along the 1967 borders. So my question is, in order to make a one-state solution and decolonization a reality, what do you think are the strategies and what's the angle that we should approach for, you know, what we can actually affect here in the U.S.?
Thank you, comrade. Maybe one more? Chica, and then we'll close up. Is there another?
That person go.
Okay.
Yeah. Just come on. I'm going to talk to these guys later.
Yeah. Chica's part of CP, so we can wrap anytime.
Hey, My name's Ahmed, he and pronouns. I'm honestly a little bit disappointed at some of the things that I heard in this discussion, actually. I think that we're all feeling the weight of the fact that there is a genocide occurring right now, and, you know, every day a lot of us are, you know, logging into our phones to find, you know, 40 Palestinians killed, 50 Palestinians killed every day. So there is a hunger for escalation, and to say that, you know, yeah, I mean, we've been doing the same kinds of protests for 10 months, and I agree with organization building, but there does have to be something more. I mean, these protests actually have to materialize into some kind of physical pressure or violence of the working class that the state actually fears, rather than one that, cops are willing to let us do. So I think that's my first question to sort of put out is, like, what do y'all think of the merit of escalation? And sort of, I'm confused about some of the comments about, the protests are fine, this is long term, because actually Gaza doesn't have much time. So we actually have to be real about that. The other thing is that I also was sort of confused about some of the comments earlier about diversity of tactics and inter-movement conflict. And I actually think that we need healthy inter-movement conflict, and we actually have to be clear about what tactics we like, what are the merits of them, what do we support and what do we not support, right? I don't think that we can just say, you know, inter-movement conflict is bad, because then the more marginal or even the more precarious sections of the movement just get purged. So I think that this is kind of a question for the room, but also for you guys about, like, yeah, like diversity of tactics, but what kinds of tactics do you guys accept? And what kinds of tactics do we think are actually against our principles?
So. Appreciate it, thank you. Okay, so maybe we can sort of do a response and then also closing out in terms of comments as well.
Great questions all around. I'll try to be very brief. In a couple of them, I think my response to them actually wants, I want to reflect back to something that Roshan said about the South African struggle and the four pillars of the movement. And I think some of the answers there are somewhat derived from maybe a bit of a too glib assertion of, like, remember which pillar you're in. You know, like, we're the pillar of international solidarity. You know, our role and responsibility here is specifically around changing the material conditions of U.S. support to Israel to give the Palestinians who are on the ground fighting for their own liberation the space and the breathing room to figure out, like, to fight their fight on their own terrain. We're not fighting that fight, right? Like, just very plainly, we have our own role to play outside of that. And I think that also, that weighs on where we intervene and where we devote our time and our resources. As it relates, I guess, to some of these questions about intra-movement conflict, I think, thank you for raising that, by the way, a very cogent perspective. I fully agree, of course, that, like, healthy discourse and you know, like, critique within movement spaces is critical and important. I think that's a different thing than that sort of spilling out elsewhere into, like, public arenas or ways that our enemies can weaponize that against us, which is a different sort of thing. And I guess, like, my short answer to what tactics are unacceptable, first of all, I think escalation is key, and I hope I didn't come off as saying that I think we should just be, like, doing marches forever for the next few years. I don't think that is the case. I agree with you that Gaza cannot wait. We are in a really critical moment, and it's important to apply pressure in every conceivable way that we can. You know, in the San Francisco Bay Area, we have a group of folks who are currently facing felony charges for blocking a bridge, you know, which I think leads to another piece of another outcome of the thing that I was talking about earlier, which is this sort of stage of spontaneity slash mobilization, the failure to convert that into like broader long-term organizing or movement building and sort of structure foundational building, one of the consequences of that is it leaves us very vulnerable to counterattack. And I think we're experiencing that a lot now. So to make sure that we have the sort of like institutional resilience, right, the organizational resourcing and capacity building and political education, to go back to a comment earlier, that needs to happen across our spaces to make sure that we're able to defend each other, that we have the resources to like fight the legal battles that are going to come through this and all of that is a key part of the fight. Again, not the sexiest part of the fight, but a really key part of it. Those sort of escalatory tactics are critical. They're critical. And anything, the question of what actions are outside of the pale, I think the short answer to that is it's not our place to critique the tactics of people fighting for Palestine liberation generally, as long as they don't, you know, violate sort of core principles on anti-racism or like anything that's sort of, you know, like misogyny or anti-queerness. But like anyone who's attacking our movement for any of the tactics they deploy, and that includes people who are like, oh, you shouldn't be like causing civil disruptions. Like, no, there's no space for that. Right. Like we don't accept people telling us what we can't do. The flip side of that is also like there are folks who are playing the inside game and like let them. It doesn't, you know, like I don't know that it's helpful for us to spend our time critiquing those people publicly. We can call them in. That's a different thing. Definitely folks need to be called in for tactics that we think may be like reactionary or counterproductive, but that's a different thing than putting them on blast publicly. And then I guess like my close is just reflecting on the ways that I think there's a lot we have to learn from past decolonial struggles. There's a lot to learn from the South Africa experience in particular, I would say, but also like looking at Algeria and Ireland and 100 other decolonial struggles. One thing that I think we struggle with, There are a lot of lessons to learn from them directly, and we have to grapple with the fact that Israel is an anachronism, right? It's a colonial project that exists outside of its time, and as a result of that, it requires a new set of tactics and a new vision, and that's hard, right? That's really hard. We don't exist in the time of like broad anti-colonial sentiment that the Algerian Revolution had, right? Even the South African like anti-apartheid victories were happening in a sort of transitioning period where like the global left was on its back foot. And we see the results of that, right? We see the consequences of the fact that South African liberation, to the extent that like, you know, the end of apartheid represents this sort of liberatory movement, still mired in the conditions of capitalism and has produced this really complicated, messy patchwork of things. We have to start thinking about those things and the ways that those material conditions are going to impact our fight as well. We're in this really odd moment where there's certain capitalist material conditions that are actually working in our favor. I know it doesn't feel that way, but like there is a sort of like broad global movement to get the violence to stop, not because anyone gives a shit about Palestinians, but because it's impacting markets, you know? And like, okay, that's a thing that we have to contend with in this moment, but that force will turn against us very, very soon, you know? So we have to be prepared for that as well. That like the fight when this sort of immediate conflict and, you know, this immediate phase of the genocide in Gaza, right? Like that what's been happening since October is obviously a genocide, but what's been happening since 1930s, not even 48, has been an ongoing genocide. So like when this phase ends, it's going to be really tricky. So even when, I do believe when, not if, but when, we sort of win this fight, we have to be well positioned to think about not only what lessons we can learn from past struggles, but how we envision a new thing. And folks talked about this earlier too, right? Like this, the fight for Palestinian liberation is a fight for a vision of a world that is different, right? It's rooted in a concept of seeing how we relate to each other, how our systems of governance, how our systems of capital, how like the economic structures that underpin our society have to be different for us to survive in this rapidly dying world. And like that's part, you know, we need to ground our analysis in that, and that's why this intersectional struggle is so important. I'm at risk of yammering, so I'll just say thank you all for listening to me yammer for an hour and a half, and I'll pass it to Roshan. Thank you.
Wow, there's so much in those questions, but maybe just on the two states, one state thing. So 1948 was one date that, you know, the apartheid regimes came into being. 93-94 was both when the elections happened in South Africa that led to our first democratic government, the end of apartheid, and then all the apartheid laws in that first parliament were repealed and replaced and so on and so on. So it was dismantled. 93-94 was also the time of Oslo. And so in a way, I don't know, you know, I think it's interesting to think about what that meant for us and what that meant for the Palestinian struggle in terms of going forward. We are now in a post-apartheid situation. I mean, that time, 1990, when the start of our liberation from apartheid came to fruition, it was the end of history. It was the triumph of capitalism. It was the demolishing of the Soviet Union and any notion of an alternative. At that moment, it was impossible to say you didn't, you know, that you were a communist, a socialist. It's not to make any excuses for the South African Communist Party, which I do think misstepped in a major, major way, and as the consequences of that are that we have a very, very, you know, practically non-existent organized left or tradition on still maintaining that space. But it was a super hard time, you know, it was the end of history. And now look what's happening now. You know, it's so, you can't know, you can't predict exactly what will happen, but you can act on certainties around your, you know, that your political belief that we know Palestine will be free. And that requires hard work. It's not going to fall from the sky. So we need to look at how did we do in other struggles? What were the conditions around that? What's similar, what's different? And I think, you know, things, we need all forms of struggle. So whether it's international law, we know it's a mess. It doesn't work. We know it's established by the Western powers for the Western powers. So when South Africa goes to the ICJ, it's a real blow because it's a global South country taking on full frontal attack against Israel for genocide. Would you ever think that was? I would never have thought that was possible. And so although we know Israel will not comply and the actual, you know, that it's not going to work in that sense, it's amazing and it's an important step, and fighting in those international legal spheres is important. It's just another field of struggle. And so there are many fields of struggle, whether we're on the streets, whether it's international law, whether it's within parliaments, you know, they're all necessary and they all require different sorts of tactics and they all require different sorts of relationships between each other. But yeah, I think, you know, we as a movement don't pronounce on the one state or two state, but it's apparent to the entire world that there is no possibility of a two state solution, not that it ever was a solution, and it's not inscribed in international law, actually, whereas the right of return of the refugees are, you know, it's law. You can make your argument with what is there, and there's some very good international law that can be made an argument of. So anyway, no one wins their liberation through the courts or international law. It's just another tool that's useful, as is the framing of apartheid. Even in spite of the genocide, I think the framing of apartheid is important because it's not just my opinion anymore. It's there, it's de jure, it's been said most recently by the ICJ. Now they say it's apartheid and they're the highest UN court. Why it's useful is because I think, and it was something earlier, someone said earlier, we also as the solidarity movement shouldn't fall into the fragmentation that Israel's imposed on the Palestinian people and the territorial divisions. And so whilst, of course, you know, that slogan, all eyes on Gaza, but, you know, obviously we're focused on the genocide that is unfolding in Gaza. But at the same time, look at what's going on in the West Bank. It's not just Gaza, it's against the entire Palestinian people. And we shouldn't be found wanting in focusing and enabling that political split, because when there's some kind of a ceasefire or some sort of a political that goes into the field of politics, it's going to be divisive. It's going to be further divisions, worse than Oslo many Palestinians say they expect some, you know, that what will be presented. So I think we should also be prepared for that and not allow another Oslo to be pushed onto the Palestinian people without their consent, as Oslo was. And having learned the lesson from that, be ready to respond. And that means we don't fall into dividing. We talk about what the atrocities in the West Bank, you know, the people in Masafayata, you know, they're just little villages in the South Hebron Hills, far from everywhere, under attack day in, day out to push them off the land. And they just resist. They have no weapons. They have no support. You know, people aren't able to come there to support them easily. And they just stay. I mean, living in caves every day. And we don't sort of pay attention to that so much now. But I think we have to find a way of you know, keeping the whole of Palestine, the refugees, the diaspora, West Bank, Gaza, East Jerusalem, West Jerusalem in 48, in our heads for when there's a need to express something politically around what's happening in Gaza, we're ready and we don't start fumbling and fall into different divisions and fall apart. I think I better stop there before I also...
Can we give a round of applause for Samer and Roshan? Just a couple of quick things. If you want to take...
Thanks for listening. If you like this episode, subscribe to our podcast and to the Haymarket Books YouTube channel, where events like this one are hosted live. And don't forget to check out haymarketbooks.org.